Good morning and welcome. It is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Ingrid Thoft. Brutality, identity, loyalty, duplicity, all great titles of mysteries written by our speaker, Ingrid Thoft. Ingrid's foray into the mystery genre introduces us to Josephina Ludlow, the private investigator in her family's Boston law firm, Ludlow & Associates. Fina's life is complicated. She works for her father, Carl, the firm's head, and is a law school dropout, much to her father's chagrin. While this may seem like the beginnings of a typical mystery story, Ingrid has used her mysteries as vehicles to address serious social issues. By weaving the issues into the body of the mystery novel, Ingrid has been able to add another dimension to the genre that is quite unique, while at the same time raising public awareness. She has won the Seamus Award for Best PI Novel. Ingrid is also the cover story of the summer edition of Mystery Scene magazine, and her book Loyalty won the Spotted Owl Award for Best Debut Mystery by a Pacific Northwest writer. Ingrid is also a member of the very prestigious blog Jungle Red Writers. This honor was in part as a recognition for her ability to take social issues, weaving them into nice, complex stories, creating a wonderful mystery series fueled by current social issues. Can you tell I'm a fan? So now, please join me in extending a warm Monadnock Summer Lyceum welcome to our speaker this morning, Ingrid Thoft.
Good morning. Thank you for such a glowing introduction, Elaine. Thank you, all of you, for being here today. It's such a gorgeous day. I know there are all sorts of things you could be doing, so I'm glad you're here to spend it this time with me. And I also wanted to thank the committee for inviting me to be a part of this wonderful speaker series. So when I was first invited to speak here, I was telling my mom about it, and I told her it's in this amazing church, and it's got all this history, and all these amazing people spoke here. And she said, a church? You're speaking in a church? And I said, uh-huh. And after the laughter died down, and it was significant, the laughter was, she reminded me of one of my few memorable church outings, which was when I was a child. We were Congregationalists. We only went kind of Christmas and Easter. And it was Christmas Eve, and I was about 3 years old, and I was with my parents. And when the minister came down the aisle in his robes, I got up and exclaimed, "The King, the King." And my parents kind of huddled in shame because I had really outed them in terms of what my religious education situation was. So I promise there will be no outbursts on my part. I can't speak for the rest of you. We're going to talk about what I call third rail issues in my books. But first, a tiny little detour. In my experience, where there are readers, there are writers. And so I don't know if there are any writers out there, either aspiring or published, but I always, when I have the opportunity to speak, I like to give a little encouragement to writers. So I'm going to show you a little visual aid, and I know this is going to be on radio, so I will describe it. This is my first book, which I just took from the table back there. I promise I'll give it back. Loyalty. This is my first book. So I'm holding up a manuscript, which I carried from Seattle to show all of you, that has about a gazillion post-it notes and flags, and it's completely marked up. And one time I held this up at an event, and my editor texted me later and said, "Oh my God, are those all my post-it notes?" And I said, "Yeah, pretty much." Now you know what it's like to be me. So anyway, that's to give writers out there hope, and it's also to let readers know what takes so long. I had a fan write to me, and she said, "I love the series. I'm 95, write faster." I said, okay. And I think her name was Edith or something along those lines. I said, okay, I'm doing my best. So that's my little detour. Today we're going to talk about third rail issues. I write mysteries, as Elaine told you, and there are some debates in the world of fiction that there is genre fiction, which is things like mysteries, sci-fi, fantasy, and then there is literary fiction. And literary fiction is where you go for your brain to be expanded, for you to contemplate weighty issues, and genre fiction is where you go to escape and just have a good time. And never the twain shall meet. That's what a lot of people think. I disagree, and I try to show that and manifest it in the writing that I do. And I didn't necessarily start out trying to do that, but that was just kind of how things evolved. A third real issue, I'm going to define it, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit more about myself before we dig into that, is an issue that could be a social issue, a socioeconomic issue, political, but it's an issue that sparks, hence the third rail part, disagreement, discussion, contemplation, and it's an issue that everyone here would approach and come to through their own experience. You would all evaluate it through your own lens. So that's what I think about when I think about a third rail issue. But first, I'm going to give you a little bit of background about how I became a published author, because people are always interested in how this works. I wrote an amateur sleuth series that wasn't published, and I had an agent, and she sent it out. And an amateur sleuth series, for those who don't know, your sleuth is not a professional. They're not a PI or a cop or an investigative reporter. And my agent sent it out, and she got the most enthusiastic rejections you can imagine. They loved this book, and they were never going to publish it. That was pretty much the message I got back. And so I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to try something different, because I want to be published. I'm not just doing this for the fun of it. So I decided that I was going to do a sleuth who was a professional sleuth, because what you bump into with an amateur sleuth is that, and I think maybe this group will know what I'm talking about, the Cabot Cove syndrome, which is from the Murder, She Wrote television show with Jessica Fletcher, where a new body turned up at her doorstep every week, even though she's just a writer. And in fact, Cabot Cove, Maine is the most dangerous place in the country, more dangerous than Chicago. And so that can be a little tricky for the writers. And it's okay, the readers, you know, that's often what happens in cozy mysteries. And the readers will forgive you that because you kind of decide, that's okay, this is how we're going to do this. But as a writer, it wasn't that interesting to me. I found the PI program at the University of Washington. I enrolled in that. It was terrific. Taught by a defense attorney, a civil investigator, and a criminal investigator. Both of the investigators were women over the age of 50. I always like to let people know that. And one of the big things I learned in this program, aside from just learning a lot of how-to in investigation, was the civil investigator in particular did a lot of work for personal injury attorneys. My father was a surgeon, so he was not a huge fan of personal injury attorneys. There was a certain bias in my household when it came to medical malpractice. But what I learned from this investigator is that for some people, those attorneys play a really important role. So if you were in a car accident and you don't have safety nets that a lot of us have, if you get injured and you have to go to the doctor or you have to go to PT, and your life is kind of a set of dominoes in terms of your work and your housing and your childcare, an accident can be really catastrophic, even if the injury itself isn't. And those attorneys can step in and they can actually get you money, basically. Now I sound like one of the ads. I can get you money. They can get you money and they can keep you from falling off that edge of the cliff. So I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating to set my mysteries in that environment with a personal injury attorney firm and to have it be a family firm, which would make it all the more complicated. So that's what I pulled away from the class, plus also all the techniques. Decided to set the series in Boston. I live in Seattle now, but I was living in Seattle at the time, but I'm from Boston. I wrote the first 50 pages that actually became this book. I sent it to my then agent. That's an important piece, then agent. And she read it and she said, oh, I love it, it's great. Could you make it darker? Could you make it grittier? And I thought, okay, I can do that, that makes sense. So I wrote the whole manuscript. And I sent it to her, and she called me, and I will always remember this call because she said, there's no easy way to say this. At which point I thought, maybe I should just hang up because this is not going to get better. And it didn't. It got worse. It's too dark. It's too gritty. I can't possibly sell this. That's what she told me. And I had this moment. I had to decide, do I stay with the agent or do I stay with the manuscript? And I decided to stay with the manuscript, which I'm glad I did, because then I got an agent who actually represented Robert Parker, who wrote the Spencer series. Any of you mystery fans will be familiar with that. And she sold it on the first submission to Robert Parker's editor. And I say that not to brag, I say it to show you the immense degree of personal preference and serendipity that happens in publishing, where one person says, I can't possibly sell this, and then the other person goes and sells it right away. So that's how I started. So the third rail, I actually borrowed that term from an interviewer. A woman was interviewing me, and she said, let's talk about the third rail issues in your books. And I said, okay, let's. What do you mean exactly? And she explained it. And I said, oh, I'm borrowing that. I'm stealing that term. I love that term. I hadn't even really realized that's what I was doing. Why do I include a third rail? The first reason, it's very selfish. I do it for my own amusement and engagement. I have a year to write a book, which in some respects seems like a long time, and in other respects is not a long time at all. But when you're doing it daily, I need to be engaged. And if I'm not engaged, then you're not going to be engaged. That's the first rule of writing that I always tell aspiring writers. So it's an opportunity for me to be excited and interested and to learn something new. It's also an opportunity for me to, as Elaine was talking about, introduce an issue. And I never go into it with an agenda. I always just go into it thinking, this is a really interesting concept. This is fascinating. I wonder what other people think about this. I wonder what I think about this. And it's also an opportunity to bridge the gap with readers. I have people tell me and email me and say, I've had that experience, and I didn't know other people who had that experience. And that's very gratifying as a writer to be able to provide that for your readers, especially when you're writing mysteries. So how do I choose the third rail? I'm going to give you examples of them in my books, but first of all, I look out into the world and I start reading and I watch news magazines and I watch 48 Hours and Dateline and Frontline and read the paper, and I look around for something that really catches my attention. And the way I think about it is like a sea sponge. So you know how a sea sponge has all those different nooks and crannies and all those places for water to go in and come out of? That's how I think about a third rail issue, because there are all these different ways to the issue, and there are all these different conclusions that people may come up with. It has to be relatable. It has to be something that all of us can take a look at, or most people can take a look at and think, oh, okay, how would that play out in my own life, or what's my experience with that? And it has to raise questions. That to me is key. And I was talking to someone about this, and I said, that's probably kind of a good life philosophy. It's something that raises questions, that prompts you to ask questions and to listen to what other people have to say. So loyalty, there are third rail issues in it, but I'm actually going to talk about it last, because when you write a series, the first book is a different animal than the rest, because you're creating the universe and you're creating your character. So it's a little bit of a different animal. I'll get back to loyalty and talk about the third rail issues there. Identity, my second book. So I'm opening my mind, I'm thinking about what do I want to write about. I read a newspaper article, and it's about a man who has recently learned that he fathered 75 children through anonymous sperm donation. And a bunch of you, your mouths just dropped open. That's exactly what my reaction was. I thought, whoa, that's pretty nuts. But it raised so many questions for me. I thought, this is so rich. There's so much there. I want to know more about this. I want to talk about this. And so right away, I started to think, well, what kind of questions does it raise? Well, it raises questions for me about what makes a family and how do you define family? How do you make a family? What happens when money is introduced into that equation, where you have people having to pay a lot of money to make a family, when you have people profiting from other people wanting to make a family, nurture versus nature? To me, these were all really, really interesting questions. And I started to do some research, and I found that it really was just the tip of the iceberg. The anonymous sperm donation industry in this country is not well regulated. It's well regulated in other countries, in Europe particularly, and in Scandinavia. It's not particularly well regulated here. It's a huge moneymaker. And it's a place where people go usually when they're feeling desperate. People go to these cryobanks, and I did a lot of research into what, you know, I kind of pretended, what if I was going to go down this road? And I learned that you can basically kind of create a designer baby. You can listen to audio files of the potential donors. You can see their baby pictures. You can read writing samples they've done. You can specify, I want someone who has a PhD in microbiology and loves to travel to Italy and speaks German. I'm not kidding, you really can. You can also say what celebrity you want the baby to look like. I can't imagine how that goes well unless George Clooney is actually a donor, but that's the kind of level of detail. I started doing a lot of research, and it was actually highly entertaining, which is also a good sign if it's entertaining to me. I did a lot of reading, and at one point my husband and I, we were having friends over, and we lived in a small condo in Seattle, and I worked at the dining room table at that point. And so I had all my things tidied up, and he said, you know, do you think you might move those, that stack? And I said, what's the problem? It's all tidy, and our friends know I work here. And he said, well, you know, that. And I looked, and it was a bunch of research books, and the one on top was titled, Knock Yourself Up. And then the next one was Single Mother by Choice. And I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Of course I can move those books, honey. So you kind of dive into this world where you learn a lot of interesting things. And in retrospect, I felt quite sure it was a third rail issue, this idea of kind of how we create families, is that I would say 90% of the time after I do an event, someone comes up to me and says, my daughter, nephew, neighbor, colleague has some experience with these sperm banks. Because, of course, it's not just single mothers who are doing it. It's lesbian couples, it's infertile straight couples. So there are a lot of people who have some experience with this, and it touches on their lives. And that goes back to the relatability piece I was talking about, where everyone here maybe knows someone or has some experience with it. And even if you don't with that particular subject, the sperm donation, you have a family or you're part of a family. And you have experience with that, and you may have ideas about how families work and what makes one. So it's really important that there's a relatability piece to it. That was identity. That's how I came up with that. The next book was Brutality. And also, just to give you a sense of the publication schedule, I'm writing a book 2 years before it comes out. So I write the book, and then it's in the publication process for a year, and then it's published. So I'm actually never trying to choose something that's timely, because there's no point. Since I don't have a crystal ball, I can't see the future. I don't know what's going to be of interest 2 years from now. But what I do try to think about is this issue really interesting to me in the moment. As it happens, I've chosen a couple issues that have appealed years later or that have resonated years later. So in Brutality, I read an article about, I say again, because of course reading, this is how I get my ideas, is reading other people's work, not their books, I'm not plagiarizing, I mean the newspaper. I read about sports-related concussions, and it was when there were just the first inklings of the lawsuit by former NFL players against the NFL, because these players were coming out and saying, the older players, saying, I'm starting to have all these issues. It's as if I have Alzheimer's and I'm much younger than that would normally occur. And I thought, again, it was like questions. So many questions are raised by this that are of interest to me. The first question is, what do we consider entertainment? What price are we willing to pay to be entertained? What price are we willing for someone else to pay to entertain us? These young players, what about tradition, and what about the values related to being macho or being tough? Where's the place of brutality within our society? And I just thought it was fascinating. I thought there was a lot of interesting stuff there. There was a lot of new research that was coming out. I read a lot about it. I read a book by a former NFL owner. I read a lot of the concussion protocols for kids that now student athletes have to follow. I finished all that quite convinced that I should only leave the house in like a helmet and bubble wrap. Because the scary thing is also you can trip and you can hit your head, or you can have a car accident and you can get a concussion, and it may not be serious or it could be more serious. So I have this image of wearing full pads to go to the grocery store. And at the same time, and this to me is how this qualifies as a third rail issue, my husband plays football as an adult. My husband played football as a child. He grew up loving football. He's a huge Pats fan. He plays football now. His family is a football family, and he can't quite imagine football not being a part of his life. He plays what's supposed to be touch football. It is not. They do not wear pads, but he plays through his league at work, and he works at Microsoft, and people always say, oh, well, they're nerds. They probably don't play that hard. No, they're all type A personalities. Trust me. They play hard. There's usually an ambulance there. No, I'm not exaggerating, by the end of the game. So it's this weird, how do we reconcile those two things when even within my own household of two people, because we don't have kids,
we can't agree on whether he should be participating in this sport that has this injury rate. And I thought, well, goodness, if that's how the two of us come at this issue, everybody else is going to come at this issue with an equal amount of diversity in their responses to it. And I don't envy parents nowadays. If I had a kid, I don't think I'd want them to play football. But the bad news that I learned when I was doing the research is it's not just football. It's football and hockey and wrestling are actually the worst offenders. Girls' soccer has a terrible rate of concussions. Baseball has a not great rate of concussions. So it's really any sport that your kid is playing nowadays. This is my little PSA. You have to learn about the concussion protocol. So that was how I got to brutality. And I thought, this is something that everyone can relate to. It's something that raised questions for me. It's something that everyone's going to have a different opinion about. And it's something, there's a big emotional piece to it. My husband can read all the research, but when come Saturday, he wants to be playing football. And not playing to him is going to be the signal of, now I am old. Even though, of course, the injuries he gets should signal to him, now he is old. But that hasn't really happened yet, despite various trips to the emergency room. So there's this emotional piece of it that I think is also really interesting in these third rail issues. You know, you can know better, but you can still be compelled to do something that maybe isn't in your best interest because your emotions are tied up in it. And I don't know how many of you saw the New York Times, I believe it was last week, but there were two big pieces of interesting information related to this. One is that the brain bank at BU, that's where ex-NFLers send their brains if they're so inclined, they did research and found that out of 110 of the NFL brains, out of 111, 110 had damage that is considered traumatic brain injury. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy is the term for it. So there's no doubt that some of these sports can cause terrible damage. And the NFL had made a $30 million grant to NIH to do concussion research. And can you believe it? They pulled their money. They decided that they weren't thrilled with the outcome of the studies because apparently football is bad for your brain. So they actually pulled most of their funding. And I wrote Brutality probably 4 years ago. And that's an issue that's become even more prominent now. So that's another example of a third rail issue. The most recent one that I tackled, and again, it's very selfish. It's about what's interesting to me, what I want to explore and research. This one, well, it was from the newspaper. They're all from the news. We need newspapers, apparently, or I wouldn't have book topics. This one was, there was a church in Seattle. And Seattle's basically quite liberal and progressive, but every place has pockets of differing opinions. And this was a small but becoming very powerful evangelical church. It had a very excited, committed membership, mostly of young people, which is attractive to churches nowadays. The pastor is this young guy who would wear jeans and a leather jacket, and he would use a wireless mic because he thought he was Beyonce when he would preach. And, you know, he was very hip, and their music during services would be a rock band. So you got the picture. And they were making a lot of money also. That's the other piece of the puzzle. And what happened, though, was that this church imploded. It seemed to be headed for this trajectory of just success and getting bigger and bigger, and instead it collapsed under its own weight. And the reason that happened is because the pastor was accused of various misdeeds, specifically being emotionally and verbally abusive to his employees and his congregants. And then there were also complaints about financial misdeeds. So I wasn't surprised by that. I thought, well, of course this guy, he didn't strike me as being terribly committed, really, to his flock. But what I found so interesting was that I went online and I started reading message boards and websites about this church and what had happened. And I found that the congregants were devastated. This was a devastating, what felt like a huge betrayal to them. My religious upbringing is quite limited, so I didn't have a lot of experience about being part of a church community. I didn't know what that was like. I wasn't raised in a church particularly. I wasn't familiar with what that was like when your whole social life was around the church, and that's what was the case for these people. Their social life was with the church. Their spiritual life was with the church. Their children came to the church. I really think they were emotionally abused, but they really were devastated, and they felt terribly betrayed, and they were at sea. They didn't know what to do. And that was the piece to me. It wasn't so much the crooked minister. That to me wasn't such an original story. But it was really understanding what the congregants were experiencing. To me, my little third rail ding went off, and I thought, this raises so many questions. It raises questions to me about faith and belief, and when do you substitute someone else's judgment for your own, and what happens when you have a fallible human being who is presumably in charge of your spiritual relationship with whatever God you worship. And it, to me, it was a perfect entree into talking about this world and talking about this religion. And I will tell you, if you guys probably don't go on treadmills up here because it's so gorgeous, you're always outside. But during the winter, if you're at the gym on a treadmill on like a Tuesday morning and you flip around the stations, you will find some incredibly charismatic televangelists who have enormous followings. You can kind of get a sense of how people get sucked into this and how they can find it very compelling. So that was so interesting to me, and I started reading a lot of books. I watched a lot of sermons on YouTube, which is kind of appalling, some of them are, but it gave me some information about what may attract people to these communities. And the other piece of it, of course, is money. Money is a big piece of it. People were giving their money to this church. So it wasn't just an emotional betrayal, but it felt really like a financial betrayal as well. Of course, what's now happened, just a little update on the pastor, is he moved to Phoenix and he started a new church. Because despite the internet and the fact that you can look up all the misdeeds and the implosion of his last church, that doesn't seem to be enough of a deterrent. So he's starting anew, and I'm sure he's going to flourish again until his narcissistic personality does him in once again. So back to loyalty. As I said, when I was writing the first book, I was creating this universe. So I wasn't thinking about third rail issues. But what I found is that, in fact, I was thinking about them just subconsciously, because that's what I like to write, and that's what I find interesting. So there are two in loyalty. One is this idea of family-owned businesses. I did a little research, and I found, and this was kind of after the fact, that family-owned businesses are a huge percentage of the businesses in the United States, which I didn't really realize because I don't have one. No one in my family has one. So when you take family, which is complicated, and you take business, which is complicated, and you mix them together, that's going to get even more complicated. That's what I've done with the Ludlows, where I have people navigating their family relationships at the same time that they're trying to navigate their business relationships. The other thing about family businesses that I found really interesting was that there was a time when family businesses were Walters and Sons. Well, you know, now it's Walters and Daughters, increasingly. The emergence of women in the workforce and showing up in such great numbers, that totally changes it also. I mean, it's one thing if you thought you were giving your business to your son, but now if you're giving your business to your daughter, how do you feel about that? So I liked that idea. Fina is the investigator in her family firm. She's not an attorney, but she has a very difficult relationship with her father. And she won't inherit the business, but her livelihood is dependent upon this family business. So it's very complicated. The other third rail issue in loyalty, and then there's actually another one I just thought of the other day when I was speaking to someone, and this one I qualify a little bit. There is a through story throughout all the books about sexual abuse. It's not a third rail in the traditional way I think about it, because there's no question that it's an abomination. A lot of people seem to forget that it's illegal also. And so that is the third rail that I have going, where in the books it happens within a family. But I'm fascinated not only with all these questions, but also with systems. So whether it's a family or a school or a business or a country, it's so interesting to me how the different parts work together. And what I found doing research on sexual abuse, which is not fun and easy research, is that the third rail piece of it comes into the part about how people respond. You would hope that there wouldn't be a huge range of responses to allegations of sexual abuse, and yet there are. And occasionally someone will come up to me after an event and they'll say, you know, the way you write the mom in the book, people would never respond that way if their child said this was going on. And I always say, well, here's the thing. Have you read the paper recently? Because you have the Catholic Church, and you have Penn State, and you have New England boarding schools. You have all of these systems where these things happen and where you have this enormous range of responses, from being receptive to, in fact, abetting abusers, essentially. So I think of that as a third rail, again, not because of the crime itself, but because of the different ways that people respond and the different
extent of denial that people have. Unfortunately, that's another thing where people come up to me afterwards and just say, I've had some experience with abuse in families. The more gratifying emails I get are not from the 95-year-olds telling me to write faster. I mean, that's gratifying in its own way, but it's from people like victims' advocates who say, I really like the way you wrote about this and that you were willing to tackle this. As I was speaking to someone just the other day about what I was going to talk about here, I realized that another third rail issue that goes throughout all the books is money, because all of this is related to money. Infertility is related to money. Those cryobanks are all, they're money makers. They're not nonprofits, they're companies to make money. NFL, it's certainly there to make money. It's not just to give you something to do on a Sunday afternoon. The mega churches, they're there to make money as well. So it was interesting, that was something different for me to think about. I do specific research to each book, as I've told you, and I also do general research. I have a reason I did it, and then I again discovered something else about that. I write two cop characters, and I wanted those characters to be realistic and to ring true. I also like hearing from people in law enforcement who say, oh, we like the way you wrote that cop, because if you screw that up, you feel badly about that. So I've done things like I've gone to my local precinct. I live right in downtown Seattle. Seattle's considered a mid-sized city. We have about a little bit more than half a million people. I went to visit my precinct, and that was fascinating. It was right in the middle of the city. It's where the 911 call center is. Got to see the holding cells and talk to a bunch of people. I then did a ride-along with one of the cops, and you're actually, most towns allow you to do a ride-along. You have to do a background check to make sure you don't have any outstanding warrants, which I don't. But it depends on the city or the state you're in, how exciting it may be, which is, it's a good thing if it's not exciting in your town. It's not great for research purposes. So I did that in Seattle, and it was fascinating. I spent the day with the cop, and the range of calls we had was so interesting. We had an assault with a deadly weapon. We had an alleged bank robbery. We had a call in at McDonald's where someone assaulted someone with a hamburger. I'm serious, I'm not making this up. We had a medical detox. We also had hours of what I would almost deem social work, where the cop was interacting with citizens who were in various states of distress. We have a terrible homeless problem in Seattle. We have a serious addiction problem, as most places do, it seems to nowadays. And there was a ton of intervention that went on. And I didn't know that. I didn't realize that that's what my neighborhood cops were doing, was that they were spending 45 minutes trying to convince a woman that she should go to basically dry out at a place the city provides. They can't arrest her. She's not necessarily doing anything that's illegal, but she's on the street and creating problems for people. So I had no understanding of that, and it was really, really interesting for me and really illuminating. I went to the morgue, which was fascinating, and saw the bodies and the autopsy rooms and the unclaimed remains, which are actually people who end up being cremated. That was really sobering. I wanted to, on the loyalty cover and on the cover of another book, my character's holding a gun, which I did not like, but I don't have choice over the covers. That's a whole other topic. And I like some of my other covers a lot. I don't love these. But I thought if my character's holding a gun, I should know how to hold a gun. I'd never held a gun before. I went to a workshop for writers that was related to firearms, and I did not get a good feeling from it. And I was telling a cop friend later, and I said, I just didn't feel really comfortable. And he said, were they a little gleeful? And I said, yeah, they were a little gleeful around the firearms. And I don't think that's a good match, a good mix. So he said, I'll take you. So two of my cop friends took me to the Seattle Police Range. And that was completely interesting and educational. And what I found is that the reason all of these different things appeal to me is because I'm kind of circling third rail issues, which I didn't even realize. And I'm circling what I also think of as intersections. That's another way to think of third rail issues. They're these intersections where all these different things collide: money, faith, value, family. And in the most literal sense, they're intersections. When you go out with the police and you have on a street corner in Seattle, you have business people. We have a huge tourist influx in the summer. And then you have people who are addicts. And then you have people who are actually, we used to have the largest open-air drug market in the West Coast. We don't anymore. They've dealt with it. So within a street corner, you would have all these different people from different walks of life and different experiences, raising all kinds of questions. How do we all coexist peacefully? How do you
not trample on anyone's rights? How do you make everyone feel safe? So I think that that's why these different experiences appeal to me, because I suspect there are some more third rail issues tucked in there that I'm going to want to tackle at some point. So I think we're going to have some questions, if anyone has any questions. Thank you so much for being so attentive, and it's been lovely, and for having me here.
Thank you, Ingrid Thoft.